Good morning. We're ready to begin this session, and our first case is Highway Citizens versus Mineta. Mr. Kaur? And Mr. Kaur, before you begin, I could say that the third member of our panel, Judge Ripple, is ill today and unable to sit with us during this session. He will listen to the tapes of today's oral arguments and participate fully in the court's deliberation of the cases.
Thank you, Your Honor. The clerk's office informed us of that.
All right. I just wanted to put it on the record.
Thank you, Judge. Your Honor, I would like to advise the court that two members of the citizens group are here today. Al Wilhelmi and Jeff Gagno are in the courtroom. Please, the court and counsel, this is a case brought under NEPA. And the plaintiff appellant seeking injunctive relief, a reversal of the trial court decision relating to the construction, two things. A, the construction of a bridge that spans both a highway and railroad, and also the relation of that bridge to other portions of the project, what we contend are other portions of the project that have been the subject of an environmental impact statement. The construction of the bridge was not the subject of an environmental impact statement. It was the subject of an environmental assessment and the issuance of a FONSI. The primary issue that the appellants are raising relates to the fact that in order to construct the bridge, pilings are driven into the ground to a depth up to 80 feet, and those pilings are in the path of a contaminant plume. There was a landfill to the northwest, I believe. It's moving south-southeast.
No, I understand it that there have been pilings already driven, a number of them.
Yes, Judge.
What percentage of pilings have already been completed?
Well, at this point, as we sit here today, the entire bridge has been constructed.
Has it demonstrated any environmental impact?
Not yet, Your Honor. And in fact, the point is that we want to stop this before there is any environmental impact.
I understand, but is there any evidence of environmental impact so far?
There is no evidence that the arsenic or TCE has reached the pilings and is migrating. There certainly is evidence of contamination.
And the contamination is there with or without the pilings.
That's correct.
Well, and then wasn't this, and I understand that you have problems with the way this was handled throughout, but ultimately, wasn't there a study in April of 2002 of the groundwater that suggested that the contamination problem is not serious and that the arsenic and TCE levels are below state enforcement standards?
Judge, I think that is one of many myths in this case, and
that answer is no.
I'm sorry?
The answer to Judge Williams' question is no.
There was a study, yes, but that study dealt with monitoring wells.
So the study did not say what Judge Williams said it said?
The study may have said that, Your Honor.
Well, that was the question.
Yeah.
Did the study say what she said it did?
The study, yes or no. I believe the study said that.
Yeah, you may have some quarrel with the study, but that's what it said.
Right, and we have a quarrel on what it's based on, or the lack of any real investigation. And what has happened here is an initial kind of speculation, and from that point on, everything seems to build back to that initial speculation. So you have the House of Cards, you get to April of 2002, but you still have not, you're still relying on reports that issued without any kind of appropriate hard look at the issue. And as an example, the April 22nd, 2000 memorandum is relied on heavily by the agencies, and it was relied on by the Railroad Commission. It's relied on throughout. And that memorandum only discussed TCE, did not discuss arsenic at all. 6 days later, there was another memorandum that talks about the importance of breakdown products of TCE and the fact that there have not been significant findings of breakdown products of TCE, but in fact there were. And That fact has been was pointed out throughout the administrative process by the citizens group, never responded to. It was pointed out in the district court, never responded to. It's pointed out in our briefs, and I don't believe it's been responded to. It's sitting there. That data is there in wells that were tested in 1986. That well has not been tested since. There were significant breakdown products of TCE. And in that August 28 memorandum, the DNR says that if there were significant breakdown products, that would be significant. They're there. It just seems to be ignored.
So you're saying that this April 2002 study really didn't test anything? What you're saying, it didn't test anything, or are you saying it relied on all these errors that you pointed out? Or was there actually a test done?
Well, there was a test done, a perimeter test, but we have the issue of a plume that is moving. And it's been the contention of the citizens group all along that the agencies don't know the limits of that plume. They don't know the boundaries of it. They don't know the depth of it. They don't know the concentrations of it. So if you have a perimeter that is safe, that the plume hasn't reached yet, and you do testing there, to then say, well, we don't have a problem because we've tested on this perimeter and we don't get hits that exceed the maximum contamination level, that still doesn't address the question of where is that plume now and where is it going, and is it going to reach those piles, and is it going to migrate through the piles? And that's been the complaint of the citizens group all along.
So ultimately, you want the pilings to just be removed, or you want them cut off at ground level?
I don't think they can be removed at this point, because if you remove it, you create that same issue that we've been talking about. Disturbing the soil creates the increased permeability that will allow contamination to flow vertically. So they can't be removed. We want them cut off, and we want them grouted. And by grouting them, that will act as a seal. So I guess that's one of the positions that we're seeking, one of the relief that we're seeking. I think at this point I should discuss probably that brownfield article, because there was an article about brownfields. And that article was looking at the question that we have brownfields out across the country, and what can we do with them, what kind of construction can we have on them. And it looked at the question of, can you drive pilings through a clay level into brownfields, and will that clay level act as a seal, in some way seal around the pilings when you drive them? The conclusion of the study was yes, that will happen. So that study supports driving pilings through a clay level in order to allow construction, because the clay will shrink around the pilings and act as a seal. It's not support. It's not support at all for the proposition that you can sink pilings through sand or gravel. That study didn't look at that question at all, other than the fact that it used grout bentonite in its when it performed the study where there was sand. What is significant about the sand and gravel is that in August of 2001, there was a question posed within the agency, I can't remember if it's the DNR or the DOT, but I think it was the DNR, saying, these pilings, are they hollow or are they concrete cast in place? If they're hollow, then I have a concern about whether I can say there's not going to be an impact. And the answer comes back, the concrete piles are cast, they have concrete in the middle. The point is, when you drive the piles, they're hollow, and then you fill them with concrete afterwards. But the point is, asking that question in August of 2001 is a recognition that the principle the citizens group has been talking about is correct, that when you disturb the soil, you increase the permeability in this sand and gravel level significantly. In fact, Mr. Thresher's affidavit said an order of magnitude of 2 to 3. I mean, if it's solved by putting the concrete in the middle, that still doesn't deal with the issue of around the circumference of the pile, the outer portion of the pile. The principle is established when he asked the question. The answer that was given, which is concrete is in the center of the pile, so you don't have to worry, and then he says, I don't have to change my opinion. Well, that's the kind of relief we're saying, and should be done in this case, putting, in effect, the grout around the outside, because there is this level area of permeability around the outside of the piles, and in order to address that, got to inject grout. Slurry grout, I believe, is what has to be ingested.
Now, one of the other things, turning to this hard look at, from a different angle, one of the things they're supposed to examine are various alternatives.
Yes.
And you indicated that, you know, the bridge was supposed to be allegedly built for safety reasons, but it was, according to you, really to facilitate this two-lane highway. But as I understand the evidence, this particular area had a high accident rate, and it exceeded the state average, and the agency document certainly suggests that safety was a primary concern, the combination of this bridge and the expansion of the highway. What's your response to that? Because I think you have a burden on that.
Sure. Well, my response is twofold. One, the safety issue existed before the decision was made to build the bridge. When talking about reasonably foreseeable, feasible alternatives, the way the project was intended to be constructed for about 5 or 6 years is one of the reasonable feasible alternatives. Highway straightening. The problem with safety is that Highway 175 crossed Highway 164 at a fairly sharp angle. And for years, this project was intended to be a straightening of the highway, some way to make the intersection a 90-degree intersection. And the citizens group has had the position all along that remains a feasible alternative, and you can control the intersection with the railroad by a gate, lights and a gate, and time the lights to any traffic light if you have some concern about traffic backing up, although that's not substantiated, as far as I know, in any study that appears that was done. I don't think a study was done on that, and I think the EA, or FONSI, says it may back up.
And is there any, and it may be in the appendix, but this, as you know, got put on our calendar pretty quickly. I haven't gone
sure.
through all the documents in the appendices, but is there any kind of plot or diagram that shows the relation of the bridge to the highway, some schematic that we can look at?
Yes, there is, Your Honor, and I know there would be one in the EA. I know also in Mr. Thresh's affidavit, which I know is at AF 97.
Yeah, just give me that site so I can...
Let me find one diagram here. AF 110.
All right, thank you.
The other point I wanted to make, Judge, is that... the last statement, because my white light has come on. And that is, if these projects, the two projects, are together, then the impact of this contamination brings into play some of the alternatives that were posed in the Highway 164 EIS and rejected. And if the contamination issue is considered in this case and determined to be an important environmental impact, that would change the equation on the Highway 164 EIS. Thank you.
And you are Mr. I don't want to mispronounce your name.
Guadagnino.
Did I get it correctly?
Very good.
All right. And you're going to divide your time?
Yes,
Mr.
I am.
Remington.
10 minutes and five for Mr. Remington.
All right.
I think perhaps the most significant aspect of this case is one of the comments that Judge Bauer made. There seems to be little dispute that there is a contaminant plume and that it's heading toward the area where these pilings are. That doesn't really seem to be disputed. Mr. Thresher, the plaintiff's, the appellant's expert, has reached various conclusions about the concentration of those contaminants, how deep they are, how wide the plume is. Those are the issues that the plaintiffs have with that aspect of the case. The real question, though, the analysis that Mr. Thresher came to was based on documents that are in the administrative record that the DNR of the state of Wisconsin and the other defendants here reviewed. So we all looked at the same thing. Mr. Thresher, though, arrived at different questions and questioned some of the information in those reports. But since there's no dispute, it's headed toward those pilings. The question is, And there's also no dispute that the pilings aren't the reason why it's headed there. It's coming there regardless of whether the pilings are there or not. The question is, what impact do those pilings have on the plume? That's really what this case is about. Although much of the brief and the plaintiff's attention is directed at analysis of the contaminants or lack thereof, the real question is, what will the pilings, if anything, do? And in that regard, their expert alleged that this theory of the latency, the process of having the piling shoved into the ground, kind of like sticking your finger in a glass of sand, necessarily displaces some of the soil that was in the way, and that the displaced sand or dirt or soil around that cylinder will be a permeable zone where water that might not otherwise be able to move vertically will. And under their theory, it will move vertically through that space and into private wells of individuals who will drink contaminated water. That's really what it's about. The August 22nd, 2000 memorandum, I think Council may have referred to that as April, maybe he was referring to a different memorandum, but it was August 22nd of 2001 I'm talking about, by two DNR experts who specifically say that the groundwater movement by the pilings in that area naturally flows vertically anyway. He also impliedly agrees with the plaintiff that there is some prospect of water coming up through that area, but the DNR report says insignificant amounts, only insignificant additional amounts of water will come up through that moved soil around the perimeter because of the pilings. An insignificant amount. So we're not rejecting what they're saying. We're just saying it was an insignificant amount. And most importantly, we looked at it. That's what NEPA is about, did we look at it? And we did, and concluded that wouldn't happen, or insignificant amounts would come up.
And then was that was the finding of this April 2002 study, which he says was really built on a house of cards?
I'm referring to an August
22nd. I know there was an August 2000 study. Correct.
Yes.
And then there was a study in 2002, in April?
I'm not, at this moment, I'm blanking out on which one they're talking about. Because there were further testing that was done in April. The state agreed to do additional testing in the area.
Well, my understanding was that there were additional studies in April 2002 which showed that the contamination problem was not that serious and that the arsenic and TCE levels were below state enforcement standards.
Some of the new monitoring wells have come with information that show decreases and some have shown increases. In fact, some of the additional documents that plaintiffs want to have considered by the court, and we'll be responding to that next week, we were advised yesterday to do that by the court, show some things that have increased. So there's been some fluctuations in that regard. But I really think that, respectfully submit, that should be the focus of the court. The evidence surrounding the pilings and the issue of whether the water will enter private wells but for the pilings. Will the water do things differently because of the pilings? I will also address something about the report that council mentioned. Yes, the DNR did inquire of the Wisconsin Department of Transportation about whether concrete would be poured within the cylinder of each piling. And state DOT said yes, it would. And council has just asserted that proves their theory. Again, number one, DNR didn't reject their theory, as I said before. They said only insignificant additional amounts would rise because the water naturally flowed in that direction. Anyway, in addition, there are two different analyses. Filling what otherwise would be a hollow pipe with concrete is a much different analysis than whether or not you pour grout around soil that may or may not still be displaced. And that's the distinction there, and it's a significant one, especially since we're saying the water's moving vertically naturally anyway, having an area that's wide open without any soil to wit a hollow pipe. Is something that the state was concerned with, so they should be credited for wanting to do that.
Let me just get back to your prior point for a minute. You indicated that some of these recent studies had shown that levels were higher, and some showed that levels were lower. I understand you're going to file a response to that, but can we hear your response now, why we shouldn't be concerned with the fact that some of those studies are showing higher levels?
Right.
Well, my first response is that, again, the pilings aren't the reason for those levels. Those are happening anyway. Again, the issue is whether they're causing them to go into wells that they might not have gone into. Second of all, my understanding is that some of this is just naturally occurring aspects of the way groundwater moves. Arsenic is one of the things in some of these detects, I think they're called, some of the results of these new testing wells, and some of that is naturally occurring anyway, and I don't know, Your Honor, frankly, what environmental factors go into variations in the contents of the different materials in the soil.
Can you, since you're looking through your notes, deal with this segment issue and explain a little more why you think the highway and bridge projects were properly segmented?
Yes. I start by saying, and Your Honor used the term projects. They are two separate projects. As you read through the appellant's brief, you will see quite often it's referred to as a project, with the Ackerville Bridge project being a component of it. That's wrong. They are two separate projects. They have separate identification numbers, etc. The bigger project, the Highway 164 project, the widening project, spans, I think, in excess of 18 miles and ends very close to this project, no question about that. That has safety considerations that is a motive, and more particularly, traffic volume considerations. It's a widening project. It was felt that had to be done now to handle the increased volume in that area. Those considerations were not part of the Ackerville Bridge project. In fact, the EA says that it's a secondary purpose. At some point, that corridor, that area where the bridge is now, will have to be expanded, and I think the estimate is in about 25 years. But principally, the consideration for the bridge project was safety, with the future expansion being the secondary project, the reason for it. There's a railroad, too, where the bridge is, which is not a component of the other project. So there were, I think the term of art in the case law is independent justification for each of them, and they both have, they don't rely on each other. They're both separate projects.
Well, one of the things in terms of the justification for the project, he says that there were other alternatives that were reasonable that should have been considered, and there wasn't a hard look like putting traffic lights there or barriers or that kind of thing. Can you comment on that?
Right. There's no question there were other alternatives, and they are spelled out in the various documents, and they were considered. And I think that's the important consideration, whether or not they were considered. And in the end, it was decided that more needed to be done. Because of the accident analysis report, getting that area up to trunk road standards, I'm not sure what that means, but there were various considerations that went into that alternative and the decision to reject the plaintiff's requested option. And again, I think NEPA is really concerned about what gets considered, not whether or not someone's unhappy about what was selected. I will just comment briefly. I always think it's a significant point of view. There seems to be a little uncertainty about the standard of review in this case. Plaintiffs articulated one in their brief. We articulated another one very similar, and it wasn't addressed in the reply brief. But I think the standard of review here is under the APA, arbitrary and capricious. This is not technically referred to as a de novo review, but in essence, it's very much like that. This court is reviewing this record and deciding whether or not the district court erred on it. The council uses various other standards along the way. I submit the one we submitted is the appropriate one under the recognized case law.
All right. I see your light is on, and if you want to not eat into your co-counsel's time.
I conclude my comments.
All right. Thank you. Mr. Remington?
Thank you, Your Honor. My name is Frank Remington. I'm an assistant attorney general with the state of Wisconsin, and I represent what we call the sort of the state governmental defendants. I appreciate my colleagues from the federal government's comments. We are, joined in the presentation of our argument today, and I don't want to repeat what's been said, but just simply suggest that I join in it as well. Let me respond with a different way of parameter of looking at the issues before the court. It is so easy, I think, for all of us to get swept up into the substantive questions that are presented in this case. The court asked the question, we should be concerned about the level of contaminants. Well, of course we should. We should, as humans, as friends or neighbors, we should be concerned about these things. The issue before the court is not an environmental question of a leaking landfill owned by Waste Management. What we have out here is we've got two things happening. We've got a landfill that's leaking and contamination that is migrating. And over to the east, we've got the Department of Transportation building a bridge. The state of Wisconsin, as you well know, is comprised of various executive agencies, the Department of Natural Resources, the Department of Health and Family Services, Division of Health, and the Department of Transportation. All three arms of state government are out there working on the collective issues, environmental and transportation, that are going on. I think the failure of the appellants in this case, or I suggest where I differ in my point of view, is their attempt to bring the two together and suggest that this court should be entrapped, and I use that word specifically, into deciding these substantive issues. For instance, I'll quote from the reply brief of the appellants, headnote 2, on the issue of alternatives. They suggest that the government rejected citizens' reasonably feasible alternatives. The issue is not what was the best alternative to suggest under NEPA. The issue is whether the government adequately considered the alternatives. The issue is not for the court the nature and extent of the contamination. That's an issue for the Department of Natural Resources and Waste Management and the environmental experts to resolve. The issue is whether the Department of Transportation and Federal Highways adequately looked at the contamination issue as it related to the building of the bridge. Now, what are the facts? I mean, the facts are, yes, there's contamination. No, the record is replete with, not only, I think one could concede, that we looked at the question, but that we took a hard look at the question. We took a hard look at the question in 2000. We took a harder look in 2001. We are still looking at the environmental consequences, the environmental considerations in the general area. I would dare say in a NEPA case before the court, you will not find better evidence of agencies that have and continue to look at the issues that the plaintiffs raise. Now, I can stand before you and defend my clients without denigrating the environmental concerns of the plaintiff. I don't think this court needs to reject to say nobody should be concerned about the environmental consideration at the Ackerville area. The question is, did the agencies, the highway transportation agencies, take a good enough, a hard enough look at this issue? The court quoted from various reports, and I think the record is replete that we looked at it, we looked at it again, we looked at it thrice, and we've continued to look at it. So, as tempting as it may be to fall into the trap of saying or denigrating my clients to say you don't know where the contamination is, that's not the issue before the court. Now, having said that, I can speak just briefly because of my background in the environmental area. I mean, to suggest that we don't know the nature and extent of contamination is a criticism one could level at any subterranean underground environmental contamination case. You can only determine nature and extent of contamination by the number of wells you drill. And that the state of Wisconsin or the federal government or any governmental agency can or should continue to spend public funds to define nature and extent of contamination for no other purpose than to know where it's going and how fast it's going. The critical importance in this case is to determine whether the contamination, as it meets the pilings of the bridge, will create an environmental consequence such that the highway should be designed differently or relocated. Now, the Department of Natural Resources for the state of Wisconsin, the experts in that agency have been involved in this project. They continue to be involved in this project. The plaintiffs suggest they disagree with the Department of Natural Resources. Well, that's good. Citizens groups should disagree with the department. That's what promotes a more reasoned and informed decision. That's what this record really supports in this case. Not that we came to the same conclusion, but that we respectfully disagree with what the plaintiffs suggest.
Thank you, Mr. Remington. Mr. Corris, and how much time? 2 minutes, Mr. Corris.
Oh, I have
Yes.
I want to point out that we're talking about a project with a need for 20 to 25 years from now, because that's when it's projected that the average daily traffic will reach this $13,000 figure. And to put some perspective on it, 25 years ago, there was still the former Soviet Union. I mean, we're talking about a long time in the future for this kind of project. I want to point out that the...
That's kind of a bizarre comparison, but go ahead.
Well, I'm trying to look at the
1900s,
and from 1904 to 1925, what happened aside from World War One, I wasn't very good on that. I want to ask the court to take a note at AAP 118 to 120 when it gets a chance. Those are the some plottings by Mr. Thresher of the arsenic levels in some wells that are to the southeast of the landfill, showing that arsenic is exceeding both the present enforcement level of 50 parts per billion and way over what will be the new enforcement level of 10 parts per billion, and also shows that it is going down in, as it moves away, it's getting deeper. They didn't look at the question. That, if you look through our reply brief and the history of what took place, they didn't look at the question. They just assumed and they carried it forward. And the last comment I would make, the court asked about April 2002. If you look at Appellant's Appendix, page 39, you will see the description of the purpose for the SPF consultant's report. They did three wells, which are shown on AF10 is MW1, MW2, and MW3, and the court will see what those are. The April 24 DOT email from Mr. Wade, or May 2nd, I'm sorry, memorandum, says that none of the data presented in this draft report in any way contradicts WDNR's findings in the memo to WISDOT dated August 23, 2000. The actual date of the memo is August 22, 2000. So that's what I'm talking about on the House of Cards.
All right.
Thank you.
Thank you.